Well, we're here today with Laura Wolf from the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Laura, I've always referred to you as the regional biologist. Is there a better title or term?
No, that's what I am. I'm a regional wildlife biologist out of the Coeur d'Alene office here in the Panhandle. And I work both in the population and habitat shops.
Laura's been on the show before. We've talked about a lot of wonderful topics. This morning, we're going to talk about the Northern Predator-Prey Study. But before we get to that, Laura, why don't you give us a little bit about your background, your own background, and then we'll talk about your role with Fish and Game a little further, and then we'll get into the study. But how did you come to be doing wildlife biology in North Idaho?
I had kind of a circuitous route around the United States. I grew up in Seattle, moved to California for my undergrad studying wildlife, and started working with the Forest Service and some of the grad students there at the university, which got me interested in going on to graduate school myself. I studied feral pigs in Georgia for my master's degree and then moved back west where I was hoping to get a career started, and started out in Salmon, Idaho with Fish and Game as a wildlife biologist. And I moved up to Coeur d'Alene about 12 years ago.
Really different habitats, Salmon and Coeur d'Alene.
It really is. Even though I grew up where it was pretty forested and you know, enclosed in places, every now and then I get a little claustrophobic in the North Idaho woods.
I don't know. Sitting down in that valley, that steep valley that Salmon is, I think I'm almost claustrophobic there.
Well,
the canyon walls all around, I guess between Salmon and Chalice, and you're driving through the wonderful canyon, and it's very scenic, but your horizon line's not all that far.
I do enjoy those views, and at least being able to see the weather coming from the whatever direction. Yeah.
Now, we take for granted that everyone knows what the State Department of Fish and Game does, and I think a lot of people who are outdoors-oriented do. We have a lot of new folks from the area from time to time. So give us a little background on what the overview or mission of work of the Idaho Department of Fish and Game is.
Sure. Idaho Department of Fish and Game's official mission is to preserve, perpetuate, and protect and manage all wildlife in the state of Idaho. And so that really encompasses, you know, studying animals, figuring out how their populations are doing, managing them, allowing hunters and anglers to take animals when their populations are stable or increasing.
Yeah, and it's a really important field of work, and every state has a Department of Fish and Game. Sometimes it's called something a little different, but a long time ago, in the compact that the states have with the federal government, it was decided that the states would have the sovereignty over managing the land for the Fish and Game within those borders of the state. So this is Idaho's approach to that.
Right. So we manage the wildlife within the state, but the mostly federal and some other state agencies manage the land. So, for instance, here, the Forest Service manages much of the public land. In some parts of the West, the BLM manages much of the land.
And I think that what's important for some listeners who might be new to the more rural areas to understand is, while the land managers might be from the federal government, it's the state who manages that resource, the fish and game population within those boundaries as well, federal and state lands.
True. And we do work with our federal partners quite a bit. So the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service to be able to manage those species, because we can't manage in a box by ourselves.
So tell us now, let's turn to this project. And it started off with another title we weren't going to use today. But the Northern Prey Predator Project sounds very all-encompassing.
Well, it really is, yeah. And the name that he's referring to, which we affectionately call internally, is the Ecology of Everything Project, because it seemed to encompass so many species and so many interactions between species, it was almost overwhelming.
Yeah. So describe that scope or range for us.
Sure. So this project started out, with an idea maybe 6 or 7 years ago from a previous wildlife manager out of the Coeur d'Alene office, who was really interested in how our prey populations and predator populations were doing and how they interacted. Here in North Idaho, we have quite a few species of both predator and prey of big game. So white-tailed deer, mule deer, moose, elk on the prey side, and then grizzly bears, black bears, mountain lions, wolves on the predator side, which adds for a lot of different combinations of interactions.
Mm-hmm. So the big game, the ungulates and the furry mega fauna, if you will, that are fierce and endearing to so many.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, they all of these species attract a lot of attention from a variety of people. Some people are very passionate about mule deer. Some people are very passionate about wolves. And so you have like this whole combination of interests across the...
When we use the word northern, we're talking northern Idaho. What's the rough geographical boundary, or is there a precise geographical boundary?
So this particular study is focused on three different game management units. So game management unit one, which ranges from Sandpoint to the Canadian border and from the Montana to Washington borders. Game unit six, which is basically the lower St. Joe and the St. Mary's River drainages. And unit 10A, which is the Dorshak Reservoir area. And so it's both the Clearwater and the Panhandle regions.
And to manage such a large area, does it break it down into subcomponents, study areas within that, or?
Nope. So we're doing capture and camera work across all of those three units.
So that was predicting the next question. Maybe you've looked at the outline. But so how is the data? What is the data that's being collected, and how is it being collected?
That's a great question. So I'd say primarily, we have been radio collaring animals, mostly ungulates, some of the predators. And with that radio collar data, we can get at survival rates, cause-specific mortality, and movement information. Mm-hmm. Secondarily, we have been deploying game cameras, remote cameras, that we were using to estimate the abundance of the species within the project. And then a more final, kind of more recent piece has been to use scat detection dogs to look at what are the predators eating. So these dogs are able to detect predator scat, and we can send them off to a lab where you can divide out that scat by genetic species. So what are mountain lions eating? What are coyotes eating? That sort of thing.
So some lab techs in the lab dividing up the scat, hopefully after it's dried out, looking for corn kernels or the equivalent, the natural equivalent of that.
I think they actually do genetic. They're actually doing the DNA. So they don't have to like pick it apart and be like, what is this hair? They're actually just putting it through a DNA analysis saying, what species is this?
A lot more accurate than the sniff test.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting. And I want to come back to the mortality question, but let's follow that train of thought. What are you finding about who's eating what?
Sure. So that part of the project was just completed maybe less than a month ago. So we had four different time periods that the dogs were out looking at what predators were eating at different times of the year. I mean, they're going to focus on different species, you know, right in the spring, you've got animals who are coming off of winter and might be in poor condition. So you're getting the larger, you know, maybe slower animals, calves that didn't quite make it through winter. Then you've got the birth pulse in the spring. So looking at what are they eating in that June, July time period, late summer and then fall. So I really only have very initial data from the first scat collection, which was in the spring. But I mean, some things that were unsurprising were like mountain lions mostly were eating white-tailed deer and a few elk, but primarily was white-tailed deer. Some of the other animals that you'll see in, let's say, coyote scat, which is a bit more wide-ranging, and can we go, you know, from white-tailed deer to snowshoe hares to small mammals to birds. So you've got a bit more of a varied diet for coyotes. Mm-hmm.
And were you able to find any wolves in the study and see what they were eating?
So the wolf data shows a lot of elk, which is not surprising. But again, it's very preliminary, and we'll get more information, and I can come back and chat about that next year.
Yeah, this is, we should let folks know, this is has just ended the study. How long ago?
I wouldn't say that it's fully ended. So
ongoing.
We have wrapped up some of the studies. So for instance, the 750 game cameras that were out across those three study areas were just picked up this fall. And so that wrapped up the abundance estimation portion in terms of field work. But we are now going through millions of photographs from even still last year and this year.
And So backing up, when were the cameras deployed again?
So we started this project in 2019. And that's when we deployed cameras, starting out in Unit 6 and 10A. Right. That's also when we started radio coloring white-tailed deer. So that was kind of the beginning of the study. And again, this is a beast of a research project. We have, 6 to 7 graduate students, master's and PhD students who have worked on this. Our research staff, regional staff, and innumerable technicians doing a lot of the heavy work.
So 4 years of photos to look through. Did the photo search research portion start already, or is this isn't the first they're looking at the photos, is it?
No. So we have looked at the first 2 years of data from the photos, and it's kind of a cool process. So these cameras are taking pictures every 10 minutes. So you can imagine how many, across 750 cameras, how many pictures we get at the end of the season. We have a neat AI program that is able to remove pictures that don't have any wildlife in them. So that cuts down on pictures. And then the AI program can actually label the picture by species. And now it's not 100%, so we still have to have folks go through and make sure it's correct. Once in a while, you'll have like a snowshoe hare, and it'll call it a mountain goat because it's white. And you're like, that's not right.
Yeah, let's double check that.
Yeah, exactly. But for the most part, it does a really good job. And so, for instance, just looking at deer pictures, we had about 200,000 deer pictures in Unit 1 in one summer.
Wow.
So, got a lot of data.
All right. We're going to talk more in a little bit about what all that means, and get to the preliminary results. But that's one phase, the camera work, and that's looking at abundance. And then there's the other part, looking at the scat to see which predators are eating what.
Mm-hmm.
Are there folks going out into the field after you detect a mortality to see, what's eating what from that end? What's being eaten? Is being eaten by what?
Correct.
The other side of the question of the food chain.
Yep. So we have been radio coloring whitetails, elk, and moose for the past 4 years, and we started out with adult females, which are a big driver for populations because they're the ones that reproduce and have the fawns and calves. And for our white-tailed deer, we actually implanted vaginal transmitters, which allowed us to find their newborn fawns and radio collar them. So we gave them very tiny little stretchy radio collars that stayed on for several months so that we could look at what was impacting survival for those first few weeks of life. I think in total we have radio collared close to 700 white-tailed deer across the three study areas. And we go out on those mortalities. So these collars are GPS collars, and when the collar itself stops moving for several hours, it sends us a mortality alert email that says this collar is not moving. It says it's in mortality, which typically means the animal has died. And so we try to get out there within a day or two so we can figure out what happened. And not surprisingly, for adult white-tailed deer, mountain lions are the number one cause of death, followed by legal hunting.
Mm-hmm.
For our neonates, so these are little deer fawns that we're catching, which this was probably everybody's favorite thing to do, is go out and find adorable small deer fawns that are not moving yet because mom told them to stay there, and find out where they're going and when they start traveling with mom. Not surprisingly, they're most vulnerable those first 6 weeks of life. Mom leaves them for the first couple weeks, and then they start toddling behind her, but they're not super fast yet. So bears are the number one predator that get our fawns, so black bears primarily, and then grizzly bears, followed by mountain lions.
Is that partly because of the seasonality of it? They're being birthed in the spring, and the bears are just emerging and hungry.
Correct. So, yeah, bears have not been eating all winter, and so there's not a whole lot, when they first come out in April, they're eating grass and tubers, and being able to get some protein with deer fawns or elk calves is good for a bear diet.
Well, that's I find that interesting. Was that surprising or is that somewhat expected?
That's pretty expected. So across the West, bears are one of the primary predators for our very young animals. So, elk, calves, and deer fawns.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Laura Wolf, regional biologist with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. We're talking about the Northern Prey Predator Study. And you're listening to KRFY, Community Supported Radio for North Idaho at 88.5 FM. Or perhaps you're listening online to our streaming service at krfy.org. We're going to take a short music break here. And an aspirational song that Laura suggested, if we can cue it up here, Walking on Sunshine. And then we're going to come back and learn a little bit more about the study. Katrina and the Waves, Walking on Sunshine, by suggestion from Laura. That's a good suggestion. That gets you up out of your chair on a gloomy day.
That's right.
So we're back at KRFY 88.5 FM, talking with Laura Wolf on the morning show, regional biologist for Idaho Department of Fish and Game, about the Northern Prey Predator study. And we've got a whole lot more things to unpack. And one of the questions that came in via text from a listener was an interesting one. How do you interview dogs for the job of going out and detecting scat? It does sound like a dream job for a canine.
Right. I think that the dogs that are chosen to do that are given a fair amount of training to be able to detect certain, either in this case, scat, or some of them are part of the conservation canine group that are detecting, you know, sensitive species. So just like they can train them on different drugs or whatever, they can train them on species that they want them to find out in the woods.
So are there particular breeds of dog that do better at this? We think of like German Shepherds for police dog work.
I imagine there are, but I would not know.
Yeah. So all comers, if someone's out there with their dog, they can take them to a company and have them trained for this.
Potentially.
Worth Googling and finding out more if you want to put your canine to work.
That's right.
So back to the study. Tell us more about some of the preliminary results. How many years is it going to take to really unpack things?
Well, I think that most of the grad students will be wrapping up in the next year or two. We are already starting to transition some of this work. So, for instance, the remote camera work to estimate abundance into more of a regional management type tool. So away from the research and moving it into management. The camera work seems to work best for those species that are a bit more abundant, which is not surprising. So white-tailed deer and elk, it seems to work pretty well. It doesn't work as well for our lower density species like, you know, mountain lions and bears. Mm-hmm. But we're still kind of tweaking that, and hopefully the research folks can come up with a way for us to use that as a more multi-species monitoring technique.
Are you going to be able to come up with or utilize any data from some of the non-targeted species? Like, imagine with 4 years of 750 cameras, there's all kinds of critters walking by. You might catch the occasional bobcat, probably, but even maybe an elusive wolverine or fisher or flying squirrel, I would imagine.
Once in a while, we do get flying squirrels. So, yeah, I mean, we're using, when we see things like if there's grizzly bears or lynx, they certainly get documented in our system. So, yeah, we're keeping tabs on where those are. Wolverines and fishers, I'm trying to think if we've seen any on these cameras. I can't come up with them, but gosh, it would be exciting. I certainly, when we get the data back, go and search by species and see if I can find some of those fun ones. Even fox. We don't have a lot of fox in North Idaho, so those are kind of exciting finds.
So what are we finding about population trends, abundance in terms of how far spread an animal is versus, you know, the numbers of those animals?
Yeah, so distribution is how far they're spread. So we're learning some things about distribution, which many of these species are distributed across most of these areas, most of these study areas. Abundance is how many there are. And so we only have 1 to 2 years in some areas, so we don't have a good trend quite yet. What I can tell you is that because these cameras tend to work best in the summertime, so we're getting estimates in that July-August range, we're getting abundance estimates for the peak of the population. So right after all the fawns and calves have been born, before hunting seasons, before you've had winter mortality. And so, for instance, the Unit 1 estimate for white-tailed deer was about 50,000 deer in the summer, which sounds like a lot. But when you think about it and think about how many will not make it through to when we usually count animals in the winter, it's like, well, gosh, that does kind of make sense. But, and the density of whitetails in Unit 1, it's comparable to moderate whitetail densities in other parts of the country. So,
are you collecting data also? I would imagine you're seeing mule deer as well.
We are, but not a lot, and definitely not enough in the cameras to get estimates for mule deer. Okay. Part of the coloring project was trying to color quite a few mule deer to get an idea of habitat use and survival. They were hard to target. Even when we were in areas where we were seeing mule deer, they just were not going into traps or whitetails would go in.
There are some common knowledge perceptions out there that probably are not necessarily accurate. But, you know, talking to friends about the interview here, a number of people commented, well, yeah, there seem to be less deer around now than a few years ago. Is it too soon to tell if that are in population decline, actually, or is it just a distribution question?
It could be somewhat distribution. I mean, whitetails can fluctuate very easily with bad winters, bad summers where it's really hot and dry and they don't have good nutrition. So they can change, their numbers can change pretty commonly. When we looked at just the difference between the first 2 years of the study, it looked like there was maybe a 1% decline going on, which is pretty small. It's possible in past years that it might have been higher than that.
Mm-hmm. I know also in the last almost 20 years now, the wolf population has gone from fairly low to somewhat substantial to the point where nobody really knew. And hunters would also suggest that the elk population might be in decline, others suggesting maybe the wolves are moving them around into different places. Too soon to tell anything about the impact, the actual population increase or stabilization of wolves and elks and the impact on each other? I mean, this is one of the hard, I think, of the prey-predator questions.
Sure. And I don't know that this study quite answers that, but in general, wolves have had an impact on elk, particularly in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. So, like, in Unit 1, that's going to be the high country in the Selkirks and the Cabinets. In Unit 6, it's going to be some of that Upper Joe habitat where it's mostly Forest Service. They do target elk in those places. We have other areas, more front country, where you have a mix of private and timber company where elk are doing pretty darn good. One thing, talking about, though, wolves as a predator on the landscape that was pretty surprising for us to learn. With our, you know, hundreds of white-tailed deer that we had collared, we expected to see some wolf mortality on whitetails just because they're so abundant. That we know wolves prefer elk, but gosh, we'd think they would take whitetails when they could. And we really had very little wolf mortality on our white-tailed deer.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That seems surprising. Maybe not. Again, this is a layman talking. Was that surprising to the biologist, or was that expected?
It was surprising. We figured that they were, you know, we know wolves eat other things, beavers, snowshoe hares, whatever they can come across. We just figured that they probably ate whitetails more than they apparently do. But we'll learn more with the scat and see what that comes up with.
Well, this is a good reason for the study. We haven't talked about moose.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, so moose has been a concern across the lower 48 with declines seen in many of those states. Idaho decided to join in along with Montana and Washington and other states back east who are studying moose right now to figure out what's going on with those declines. And so we've been collaring moose in those three study areas I mentioned, but also other places in the state. So we have statewide data for moose. We started out collaring cow moose, thinking that, again, they're driving populations. But what we found was that moose survival, cow survival, is pretty good. So about 90% annual survival, mm-hmm. which is decent for a large ungulate. And so we've kind of transitioned that project into really focusing on calves. So moose calves appear to be driving the declines. You might hear a helicopter out this week here in the area north of Sandpoint. We're trying to get more radio colors on moose calves right now. So hope that this fog lifts.
Yeah, let's hope so. It was maybe 10 years ago that there seemed to be a pretty steep decline in the moose population, nationwide, as you were suggesting. And I'm not sure there was ever a definitive reason for that I heard, but it seemed to be more driven by a bacteria or a virus or something going on in the ear.
So what we found statewide, the top 10 causes of death for cow moose are all parasite and disease related. So you might be thinking of, I'm not sure if you're thinking of the carotid artery worm. So that's one of the most common causes.
That might have been
it. That's a parasite transmitted by horse flies. And the worm lodges in the carotid artery and prevents blood flow to the brain. So you might see cropped ears or blindness, that sort of thing, and can cause death. ticks are obviously something everybody knows. You'll see, you know, ghost moose where the ticks are causing problems. And they seem to just get infections really easily. So they might just get a cut on their leg and they die of sepsis quite easily.
So is that a long-standing phenomenon that was only really discovered about 10 years ago? Or is that something that wasn't endemic that suddenly got arrived on the scene?
No, it is endemic. It's possible with, you know, whitetail populations are higher now than they probably were historically, and they can be a host to this, so it doesn't impact them negatively. That's a hypothesis.
It could be spreading. It
could be. I mean, I don't know if horse flies are higher in densities than they used to be, but it's likely that much of this has to do with our warming summers and warming winters where, you know, we don't have things to have deep freezes, which moose are meant for, right? They're Arctic type species. And then hot, dry summers are just real hard on them.
So any estimate of whether the moose are doing, how are they faring?
Stable to declining. It depends on where you're looking. So what was really interesting is that we found much poorer moose calf survival in unit one compared to unit six. So this very northern part of the study area had lower pregnancy rates, lower twinning rates, lower calf survival compared to the St. Joe, which is not real far away. We don't really have a good guess as to why that is, but we are seeing differences.
You mentioned the climatic effects. Is there enough data from this to look at whether there's any impact from climate change?
I think not specifically for this project, but when we see things like parasites and we see particularly like ticks, which we know if you have a hard freeze, they're not as many of them are going to make it through. It would make sense that climate is having an impact on you know, tick effects on body condition and particularly calf survival.
Mm-hmm. I remember there was a listener that wanted me to ask this question, and about 10 years or so ago, a number of local organizations and volunteers assisted with something called the Multi-Species Baseline Initiative, which was targeted really at rare forest winter carnivores, the mustelid family primarily, wolverines, fisher, marten, and then also lynx. And there were about 400 stations, I think, as I recall, in that study. Was there a connection between that study and this? Are there data sets that could be cross-compared?
No, these two studies are not related. So like you mentioned, that was focused on species of greatest conservation need, and actually part of it involved amphibians and reptiles as well. Mm-hmm. And this one is a bit more focused on our big game, large mammal component of the northern forest. I guess it could be similar in that there were cameras involved in both. So some of the similar techniques that we used, but yeah, it was a bit different.
I think at least in the last couple of years, they also co-located climate data collectors. So temperature and moisture, I think, at least. Was there any climate data collection at the camera sites here?
There was not, although there has been one of the grad students that was working on some camera data was looking to see if we could use these remote cameras that we're trying to count animals on to measure snow throughout the winter. Because right now we have snowtell sites that are at a few specific mountains, and you might get snow data down low elevation, you know, in town. But we don't get a good idea of what's going on mid-range. And so having all these cameras out here, we can get snow measurements through the year, and that will be really useful for climate change.
When it comes down and when it thaws out.
Exactly.
Well, that will be interesting, too. Any other interesting things found out or anticipated that we haven't talked about?
Gosh. One of the other things that I thought was kind of interesting was, you know, with radio colors, we can look at movement data. So what we found across all three study areas that for white-tailed deer, nearly half of them migrate, which we kind of expect our big game to migrate, but half of them are actually resident and have smaller home ranges and don't actually go anywhere, stay in one spot all year. The ones that migrate go about 10 to 12 miles to summer range and then come back in the winter. So
For the
whitetail.
Are you able to, that's a good question about the summer winter range. Are you able to make any assessments about summer winter range for the elk?
It seems like the majority of the elk here in Unit 1 do have some seasonal movements, and some of them go pretty far up high into the Selkirks. Not too many have kind of smaller home ranges, but that does seem quite related to location. So like our Unit 4 Coeur d'Alene elk have home ranges. They really don't migrate at all. And then the Joe elk, it kind of changed. the further upriver you go, the more they migrate. So the mm-hmm. ones that are closer to St. Mary's have like kind of little few mile migrations. And as you get towards Avery, they migrate up over into Montana.
So it really depends where they are.
Mm-hmm.
What about the cabinets?
There's definitely some movement in the cabinets too. I mean, you have some elk that, you know, have found a happy home in the Kootenai Valley. And mm-hmm. so they don't want to go anywhere, but most of them do. Yeah. Move up into the cabinets.
Yeah. Great. Well, what's next?
So next we have, oh gosh, so much data analysis with all this project, all the data. We're still monitoring all of our radio collared animals. So we have whitetail, elk, and moose that still have radio collars. Mm-hmm. So we are tracking them and getting cost-specific mortality, continuing with our moose research. And we're going to move our camera work into probably unit 3 and 4 coming up. So using that camera data. To continue monitoring big game.
One other animal we haven't talked about, and I suppose because it's a fairly narrow range, not very many of them, the mountain goats. Any data on those? Any cameras deployed high enough up to collect any data?
Gosh, the cameras that we're using, they're randomly placed. So mountain goats are very specific to rocks, not that they right. don't wander off sometimes. So we did get a mountain goat on one of our wolf monitoring cameras in Unit 4 this year that was like, up near McGee area. It's like, oh gosh, you're not real safe in the trees here. But no, we don't have any mountain goat data from this project.
Yeah, I didn't think so. But, you know, it's always interesting that a lot of listeners know about and are concerned about the mountain goats.
Yes, so, well, they're my favorite, so yeah, I understand.
I know, and you spend a lot of time with them, or studying them, I should say.
Yes.
But, yeah. Well, Laura, it's always great to have you on. Before we part, any closing thoughts for us?
No, it's been great to come on, and I'm happy to come back in a year or so when we have a bit more results to report. Oh,
absolutely. Well, we will plan on that. We can't set a precise date now, but listeners should anticipate about a year from now. We'll have Laura back on to look further, more deeply into the Northern Prey Predator Project. If you've just tuned in, we are hopeful that this is being captured as a podcast. I've lost control of that computer in the room, but I'm told it's being recorded remotely for that purpose, so tune in for that. This is KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho, 88.5 FM. You can listen to us live stream at krfy.org. I would have events for you, but right now I'm going to see if we can go to a music song and come back and find those. This has been the morning show for Tuesday. Laura Wolf, regional biologist with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.